This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the UC San Diego Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. My name is Steve Clary. I'm the chair of the curriculum committee, and very pleased to welcome you to this afternoon's lecture. We're very pleased to also to welcome back to Osher retired Navy Vice Admiral Charles Martoglio, who is here to offer his perspectives on Europe, the challenges facing NATO and the EU, security, developments with Russia, how Russia sort of arrived at where it is today, and what the future looks like in the face of some of these challenges. Admiral Martoglio will conclude, however, with his view that America will remain economically, diplomatically, and militarily the most powerful nation in the world for generations to come. Admiral Martoglio has a distinguished Navy record, both operationally and as one of the Navy's foremost strategic thinkers and planners. He commanded the Ronald Reagan Aircraft Carrier Strike Group, served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Chief of Naval Operations, and his most recent assignment was as the Deputy Commander of all U.S. military forces in Europe. He is now pleasantly retired here in San Diego, where he is a research professor and associate at the UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Please welcome Admiral Charlie Martoglio, my good friend and our notable speaker, to Osher today.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, everybody, for braving today's warm weather to come out and sit and listen to our discussion topic. I love putting this slide up because when people see it, they sort of gasp because they think I'm going to talk about every bullet on this slide. And I will.
No, I won't.
Every bullet on this slide, every bullet is at play in Europe today as we sit here. And almost every bullet is interrelated with three or four or five other bullets on this slide. And while it's very easy to come up with seemingly simple solutions to single issues, the complexity is how to fix issues that affect multiple other issues whose constituencies are different, whose interests are different, and it gets very hard to do that. And so the bumper sticker at the bottom of the slide is the main takeaway from this slide, and that is that no issue is an island. There are no single issue solutions that stand by themselves. And I'm going to talk about just a couple before we move on. And they mostly are in the upper left-hand side of this slide. Probably the single biggest issue facing Europe today is the issue of European cohesion. And if you're trying to figure out what's the primary reason why this is the case, it's because the central decision-making authorities don't have to live with the impact of the decisions they're making. Sound familiar? And I would say that this is a common theme in lots of places around the world today, not just Europe. All the great democracies, where you find the populations are about equally split and becoming increasingly polarized. That is not a good thing. People think of Europe and they think of this homogeneous entity. And Europe is anything but homogeneous. You've got north-south competitions, where the economics and productivity of the North are stronger than the economics and productivity of the South. You have different threat perceptions. You know, if you're a Baltic nation or Poland, your perception of Russia is significantly different than if you are Italy. And your perception of the threat caused by migrants is perceptively different if you are Italy than if you are one of the Baltic nations or Poland. And so this is a very large geographic space with lots of poles going on. And probably the issue that has set off the poles the most is the issue of refugees and migrants. And there is a difference between refugees and migrants. Refugees under international law, you have to provide security for. Migrants, also known as economic migrants, you do not. But in the very confused, war-torn milieu that they are coming from, where there are no records, and people certainly aren't going to volunteer that they're a migrant and not a refugee, it's very difficult to break them apart. Extremism and foreign fighters. This has been an issue that we, the United States, have been talking to Europe about for many, many years. Because we have seen the people flowing into Syria in particular, knowing that at some point they are going to come back and they're going to have a different, more radicalized value set than when they went over. And terrorism, extremism, isn't a military issue, per se. Inside of national borders, who owns that issue? The nation, and it's typically, and especially in Europe, it's law enforcement. It's a law enforcement issue, and it's a national issue. And yet, who controls the sluice valve coming into Europe? Is it individual nations? No, it's the European Union. So there, again, there's this disconnect between those that have to live with the issue and those that are in control of the issue. And for any of you who have worked business and privacy issues in Europe, you'll know that privacy is an extraordinarily protected attribute in Europe, which sometimes is good, but when you're fighting extremism and you're technologically sophisticated like Europe and America, there's got to be a balance there between protecting privacy and protecting the people and the population. And the Euro crisis has kind of quieted down in the last couple months. I'm not so sure it's quieted down as opposed to other things have replaced it in the international limelight. Because there are still issues bubbling on the surface, not under the surface. Italian banking stability, new government in Portugal and Greece is certainly not out of the woods yet in terms of their deficits that will bring the Euro crisis back in the not too distant future. And so you can see there are economic, there are diplomatic, and there are military elements to everything that we were just talking about, and they're all in play. So let's talk a little bit about NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, established in 1949 to safeguard Europe from the Soviet Union. Today it has 28 members. And sometimes you hear NATO expansion is not a good thing, especially as it relates to Russia. But most people don't realize that the evolution of NATO or the expansion of NATO has been a core tenet of NATO since it was established in 1949. It has expanded six times since then. If you look at the NATO Alliance Treaty that all the members have signed and pledged, Article 5 is the one that gets the most interest because it's the one that basically says, if one member is attacked, we treat it as if all nations are attacked. In other words, all of NATO comes to the defense of the nation that is attacked. How many times has Article 5 been invoked? Yeah, you guys watched the debate last night, huh? One time, after 9/11, when all of the NATO nations voted to come to the aid of the United States of America in the wake of the 9/11 attack. It's a consensus alliance. What does this mean? It means that for NATO to do anything, all 28 nations need to agree. If one nation does not agree, NATO can't function. Remember at the very beginning we talked about that wide disparity of views on security, on economies, on diplomacy. Imagine trying to get 28 nations to agree to do anything. That's a requirement for NATO. And part of the treaty is the recommendation that all nations spend 2% of their gross domestic product, at least 2% of their gross domestic product, on defense and defense issues. Of the 28 nations, 4 currently meet that threshold. The United States, the United Kingdom, Greece, and Estonia. Now, Poland, Turkey, and France are at 1.9. The others are at a level below that, including some economic powerhouses. And yet, because of what's going on in that part of the world, the economic powerhouses in particular are now increasing their outlays because they, like us, realize there's inherent value in working as part of a powerful alliance. So what is this alliance all about? We are more powerful because every nation in the alliance is a democracy, and it values the rule of law and human rights and free markets. Those are NATO entrance requirements. So not only are we bound together in terms of thinking about security, but the cornerstones of our nations are the same. So there's this cultural affinity in addition to the security affinity. And so let's take a look at what NATO represents. Remember, I started out by saying NATO started out as a military alliance against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. When we talk about the transatlantic bridge, America and Europe, what are we talking about? America's gross domestic product is about $17.5 trillion a year. That's the sum of goods and services that America produces. The largest economy in the world is the European Union, at least until the UK exits. The European Union's economy passed America's economy in the size of the GDP in 2012 by about $200 million at the roughly $18 trillion a year level. What does all that mean, and why am I throwing around all these numbers? America and Europe each represent 25% of the world's gross domestic product. Together, we represent half of the world's gross domestic product. And that's a pretty important figure when other nations in the world are trying to rewrite the economic rules with which the world operates. Having 50% of the economic firepower counts. Diplomatically, Europe votes with America at the United Nations more than any other part of the world. And militarily, you can see the number of troops, aircraft, ships. And it's a battle-tested alliance because our NATO allies have been with us in Afghanistan from the beginning, comprising over 85% of the international coalition has been NATO. 85% of the international contributing nations come from Europe. What's our role in NATO? I've kind of broken it down into two bullets. It's our military contribution. And in peacetime, it's those pieces that America brings to Europe that add to two things: reassuring our friends and allies that we're there and part of the alliance, and deterring adversaries and potential adversaries from picking a fight with us. And if you will, they are opposite sides of the same coin. Reassurance of friends and allies, deterrence of adversaries and potential adversaries. And so when you look at what really deters, it's ground combat forces, it's tactical aviation, and it's the combat enablers that allow you to use those forces already positioned in Europe to credibly thwart an adversary. We also provide, we the United States of America, the military leadership for NATO. The Supreme Allied Commander of Europe is always an American admiral or general. In 1997, now this is roughly 7 years after the wall came down and lots had changed in Europe. People were getting along. The idea of large-scale conflict was receding. Russia was brought into NATO, but not as a full member, but as a participant in the discussions. And to do that, the Founding Act, which was signed by Russia, highlighted the respect for sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of nations, and those nations' inherent right to choose the means of their own security. Apply that to Ukraine. So why is Russia like Russia is? And I'm not here to apologize for Russia by any stretch. But we talked about the importance of knowledge in making decisions. And you have got to understand either the adversary or the competitor or even the group or person you're trying to cooperate with in order to have an effective decision-making and an effective policy. There are a lot of words on this slide, and let me explain a little bit of it. If you look at all of the items separated by commas, Kipchaks, Mongols, Teutonic Knights, Swedes, the number after that is the year that that battle took place, or that war took place. And if there is not an asterisk, it means those folks attacked what was then Russia. If there is an asterisk, it means Russia was expanding its borders because in their mind, a defensive buffer is the key to security because they've been invaded so many times to such detriment. As Americans, we don't see that so much, do we? Why? Because we're separated by two massive oceans, and we've got neighbors to the north and south that are friends, not military enemies. So it's a very different mindset, this idea of borders and buffers, if you're a Russian than if you're an American. And if you look at the bottom of the slide, just in the last century, the level of violence that the Russian people have either absorbed from outsiders during two world wars or through repression internal to Russia, those numbers are staggering. 40 million people killed. And that plays in the Russian psyche, and it is exploited by the Russian leadership. So the Russian people, they think in terms of defending their nation through buffered borders. They tend not to like other cultures. And because of that, they are very willing to tolerate hardship, economic hardship, political repression internally, and sending troops to the border areas to fight and die in order to defend the motherland. That's what, among other issues, is a key driver of Russian policy. Doesn't mean it's good, and it is exploited by the leadership. But that's why Russia is behaving like it behaves. The fundamental difference between the West and Russia can be boiled down to this. In the West, the state exists to support the people. In Russia, the people exist to support the state. That's huge. That's a fundamentally different way to look at the real world and the allocation of resources and the toleration of hardship. And that is a very, very difficult bridge to gap. It does underpin Russian motivation during challenging times. World War II, the Cold War, and today. And today, the Russian leadership is exploiting the people's fear of returning to the chaos of the Yeltsin years, when the economy collapsed, when security collapsed, when internal security collapsed, when there was general chaos in a very large and important country. And when we talk about expansionist activity, what is Russia doing in expanding its influence around the world? The bottom three bullets are categorized by Russia working bilaterally, individually with other nations, Russia working multilaterally in a group of nations that Russia leads, and then lastly, what they're doing in terms of intimidation and aggression, and what they've done over the recent timeline. And so you can see bilaterally, Russia is working with China, Syria, Iran, Venezuela, Egypt, and Cyprus. Some not so nice places there. Multilaterally, you look at that and you're saying, well, they're trying to improve their economy and they're trying to recreate something akin to the former Soviet Union. I don't think that's entirely accurate, but they are trying to build something that puts those border buffers back in place between potential adversaries and the Russian homeland. And then you look at, and I like to look at things with common sense and pragmatism, look at the record of what Russia has done just since 2007. Estonia, that was a massive cyber attack against all things Estonian from inside of Russia. Georgia was a physical invasion of Georgian sovereignty, again, under political contexts. But the fact remains that there were Russian soldiers shooting into Georgian sovereign territory in 2008. The Zapad exercise series, nothing wrong with exercising your military forces. It is a good thing to do. It's a prudent thing to do. We do it all the time. And Russia started doing it in 2009 on a very large scale, including in very provocative positions, like just east of the NATO border. Again, nothing fundamentally wrong with that, because you want to train where you may fight. But if you're looking to add to security and stability, that may not be your best choice, unless you really believe you're going to fight or have an intimidating effect on your adversary, in this case, NATO. Ukraine, Crimea, that was just naked aggression against a sovereign nation in violation of agreements that Russia had signed in the wake of the Cold War. Their 2014 military strategy, which rearticulated some of the new nuclear principles regarding the use of nuclear weapons by Russia. Horrendously irresponsible discussions by President Putin and other members of the senior Russian government. The thrust of which is we escalate to nuclear weapons to de-escalate. Phenomenally dangerous gambles. And then Syria. And you'll see we've been trying to work with the Russians to get some modicum of control in Syria. And the reports over the last 24 hours have been very, very disheartening. If you talk about Russia, you got to talk about President Putin. First part of his career in the counterintelligence services, the KGB, in St. Petersburg, and in Germany. And in the fall of the wall in 1989, shortly thereafter, he retired from the KGB and went to work in the government, initially in St. Petersburg, then he moved to President Yeltsin's administration. And then in a relatively surprising move in 1999, Yeltsin appointed him as prime minister over hundreds of other people that were more senior to Vladimir Putin. And then Yeltsin resigned and appointed Putin president. But then he ran for office in 2000, was elected. You can see the outcome of the elections there. At the time it was 4-year terms, you could stand for two. Yeltsin did turn the presidency over to President Medvedev, 2008 to 2012, and then reassumed the presidency after that gap. And they changed the length of the tour of office to 6 years. So now, should Putin choose to run in 2018, which he will be around, and we will have to deal with him until 2024. So what is his ideology? I'm going to start with something that's at the bottom of the slide. The quote from Yeltsin, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. That's President Putin's mindset. And you hear him say things like sovereign democracy. How many people are for sovereign democracy? I am. It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Until you figure out what the definition, his definition of sovereign democracy is, which is that nations have the inherent right to make their own rules. Sovereign nation, I can make my own rules. Traditional values, things like human rights, women's rights, rule of law. Who's against traditional values? Except to President Putin, that means from a national perspective. And if you disagree with either of those two, you're met internally and externally with aggressive nationalism. Militaristic externally and police internally. And so who is Vladimir Putin? Is he the defender of Russia? Yeah. Is he an imperialist? Is he trying to push the borders of Russia out? Yeah. Is he an opportunist? He himself said he was an opportunist when it came to Ukraine. And people try to figure out which of the three is he. I think he's all three. And there's some good, and there's a fair amount of bad in some of the three. Parsing through that is what we expect our national leaders to do. So what are the friction points with Russia? I've broken this down into two categories. Those things that we argue about and that we compete in, and those things that we may conflict, but on the low end of the conflict scale. Remember, we were talking cooperation, competition, and conflict. Those are the things that fall into the challenges. Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, and the Baltics. Iran, Russia's embracing of Iran. North Korea, our ballistic missile defense policy, global nuclear policy, global cybersecurity and space policy. Those are the primary friction points with Russia. A red line, on the other hand, from the Russian perspective, these are the things that this is my list, nobody else's. These are the things that I believe Russia will use military force if we, the West, encroach. Doesn't mean we shouldn't encroach or we shouldn't use military force. It just means if you're a decision maker that's looking at the risk reward, you need to know that Russia will respond very forcefully. If there's an attack on the Russian homeland, if there is aggression towards Kaliningrad, you know, which is a part of Russia surrounded by Lithuania, the Baltic Sea, and Poland, it doesn't actually touch Russia anywhere, but make no mistake, it's Russian territory. NATO membership for the three nations listed up there. Ukraine was a demonstration of that. The Donbass region of Ukraine. Syria. There are a variety of reasons why Syria isn't played, but it comes down to geography. And it's the ports and airfields that Syria represents to the Russian military in terms of being able to get out of the Black Sea, operate in the Mediterranean with access to the Atlantic, and reprovision without having to go through the Turkish Straits back into the Black Sea. Syria is very important to the Russians. And having a Russian-friendly government in Syria, not necessarily Assad, but a Russian-friendly government, is something that Russia will fight for, as they are doing today. And then the Turkish Straits, the ability to get out of the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean. And of course, who controls the Turkish Straits? The Turks. The banner at the bottom, I believe, is correct. Clearly, Russia is not seeking global domination anymore like the USSR, like the Soviet Union did. But it will use military force if its red lines are threatened. Again, that doesn't mean we can't do anything. It just means we need to be aware. And that has to be part of the calculus by decision makers so that you don't just blindly stumble into something that spirals out of control. Zones of cooperation. This is what makes good strategists separate from strategists. And what makes good senior military officers separate from military officers? Our job is to preserve options for our civilian leadership such that if a crisis comes, it's not foreclosed in what we are going to do. There are a range of things that we can do. And good strategists know that all nations act in their own self-interest all the time without exception, including the United States. All nations act in their own self-interest all the time without exception. If you know that and if you believe that, good strategists are then able to look at multiple situations and see where national interests may overlap such that you can work together. You can be on that cooperation side of the cooperation, competition, conflict spectrum while you're competing and maybe even on the lower end of the conflict spectrum. And that's what you want your national leaders to be able to do. This is my list of things that we ought to be thinking about doing with Russia. Some of them you can read about in the newspaper. It's the implementation of the Iran nuclear agreement, since we're both signatories to the agreement. Syria, illegal drugs is a phenomenal problem in Russia. Phenomenal problem in Europe. Phenomenal problem here. Can we work together on that one issue? Weapons of mass destruction proliferation. Stability in Afghanistan, as much a Russian interest as an American interest. Arctic development, you can see the other. But the banner at the bottom of the slide, you got to have that overlapping interest But you've got to have a willingness to work together and, most importantly, trust. And how do you build that trust? Does trust come when I have a crisis and I pick up a phone and I call you and I need your help or I have a proposal? No. Trust is built through years of relationships that get you to some level of cooperation so that when the crunch comes and you call me and say, Charlie, I commit to taking course of action X, I take you at your word and can de-escalate along with you. Either with observables or based on trust. But if that trust isn't there, like it's not there today with Russia, if you see what's happening in Syria, you can't get to zones of cooperation. You can't get to a particular zone of cooperation. But if there are areas where you can work together to establish those working level relationships such that I can cooperate with you, and when you tell me something, I trust you to be able to implement it. That is why we do this sort of thing. And that is why secretaries of state of both parties run around the world trying to work zones of cooperation in the middle of competition and conflict. Let's talk some realities. NATO on the left, Russia on the right. Remember I said Russia is an issue to be managed, not won. We can do that because time is on our side. We don't have to make precipitous decisions that may turn out to be bad. Because look at the numbers. There are 800 million people in NATO. A little less than 500 million in Europe. And about 340 million in the United States. Against a population of 146 million. Demographically, Russia is in precipitous decline. Europe is in decline. And America's in pretty good shape. In fact, America demographically is in the best shape of any developed nation in the world. Remember we said the economic element of national power is the most important? Diplomatic, military. Look at the overmatch of the West compared to Russia. The GDP of NATO is $35 trillion a year, and Russia is $1.8 trillion. And look at the size militarily of NATO. Who's going to win this competition? It's not Russia. So the attributes, the numbers, the power is on the side of the West if we wield it wisely. And that means a combination of economic, diplomatic, military, and informational carrots and sticks. So what's different this time compared to when Russia was the Soviet Union? The first thing is Putin will run out of time because he no longer controls what all of his people know and can find out if they are so inclined. And over time, their mindset will likely shift because if information is out there, everybody has access to it. It's this idea of ubiquitous information. Famous picture of a babushka sitting in the steps in Russia working on a wireless computer. dramatic economic overmatch. I mean, look at that. $35 trillion versus $1.8 trillion. And how many people here knew that the GDP of the state of California is bigger than the GDP of Russia? Now, I don't mean to minimize the capability of Russia or be insulting to Russians. I'm just trying to look at the cold facts that tell national leaders the spectrum of options that they have in front of them and the time horizon to implement them. We must, as a nation and as a member of NATO, reassure our NATO allies and have sufficient deterrent capability all the way from global nuclear to conventional warfare, and that deterrence is the right capabilities at the right level of readiness, at the right location, and the national will to employ those forces aggressively if deterrence fails. And I, as a military person, can tell you with certainty that the uniformed military would rather deter, credibly deter conflict than fight. But in order to deter, you've got to have that national will to engage in conflict, even though you don't want to. And that takes the right capabilities at the right level of readiness, in the right location, and the national will to employ them. I'm going to start cutting to the end here. We talked about America being the glue that holds NATO together, and that NATO generates European security, which is critical for the prosperity of Europe, but it directly benefits the United States of America. The European Union is our number one trading partner globally. That turns into money and jobs. And the cost of that prosperity, that $18 trillion European Union GDP, is the cost of maintaining America's role in the alliance, which then has a disproportionate return back to America in terms of dollars and jobs. So the NATO alliance, which started out as a military alliance focused on the Cold War, has a huge economic piece to it now, because we are the glue that kind of holds it all together. And it impacts us economically, diplomatically, and militarily. Dual track approach with Russia. There are carrots that we can and should employ. Confidence building measures, zones of cooperation, things that we can work in so that I have confidence in my Russian counterparts. You gotta maintain working and senior level, at least contact relationships, so that if a crisis occurs, I know who to call and the person will take the call. Whether you resolve anything, situational dependent, but you gotta have those relationships in place. And then a measured stick And I have an example from economic element, diplomatic element, military element, and the informational sphere. Time is on the West side. So we can be judicious about how we work this issue. We don't have to be precipitous. Last slide. I love to end on this slide. A lot of you will remember the things that are in the cloud on the left-hand side of this slide. These are all of the things since the end of World War II that supposedly presaged the settling of America. America was going to lose its greatness, be replaced by another nation or another group of nations. When Russia tested its hydrogen bomb, the fact that the Korean War ended in a truce and not a victory. How many people remember Sputnik and the missile gap? What a crisis that was. Vietnam War. Remember the misery index of the 1980s? Inflation plus unemployment? How big that number was, the 9/11 attacks? How about Japan buying America? Well, how did that work out? America's sunset has been predicted many, many times over the past 60 or 70 years. So why have none of these come to pass? And I believe it's because there are attributes that are unique to America, unique to America that we have all of these attributes, and unique to America that we are the best in the world at each one of these attributes. And none of them have anything to do with politics. These are the attributes of a great nation. And I'm just going to hit a couple of them before I wrap up. I've already talked about the favorable external geography. You have an expeditionary military. Why is it important that we have allies overseas? Because guess where our military forces are? They're overseas. That's where we fight our wars. We don't fight them on the beaches of San Diego, Norfolk, and Florida. We fight our wars overseas. In football parlance, we do away games. You want us to do away games. We can't be overseas without the permission of the sovereign nations that are allied with the United States. It's not just a cash transaction. It's how we defend ourselves. We have an extraordinarily diverse economy. We are the best in agriculture, the best in industry, the best in technology, the best in medicine, and it's all in America. I often hear, but the dollar. To which I say, what's going to replace the dollar? Is it the euro? I think not. They're having enough troubles maintaining the euro today. Is it the Chinese yuan? Absolutely not. Why? Completely different lecture. But the Communist Party of China will never let go of the yuan and never let it float free because that's how a cornerstone of how they control their economy, and that's how they control China. Is it the yen? No, it's just not a big enough currency in the global marketplace. There's nothing to replace the dollar. Last thing I'll talk about is energy. What is the bottom line of fracking? Fracking, the extraction of oil out of the earth from shale, is the sluice valve that now determines how much oil is on the market. And how much oil is on the market determines the cost of a barrel of oil, right? Who controls the sluice valve? Is it the Saudis, the Iranians, the Russians? It's the United States of America. It's American fracking. So the days of being held hostage to high oil prices are gone for our lifetime and for generations. Now, I don't mean to simplify some of the complex policy issues relative to fracking, but the technology is there, the oil is there, and it's a very simple process to turn it on and off in comparison to other oil extraction techniques. This gives us an incredible amount of power above and beyond what we already have. So I get to my last point, which is the banner at the bottom of the slide. There's a unique combination. Our location, our resources, our economic power, our technological, all of those things added together are the cornerstones that will hold America in its leadership position. Not only in our lifetime, but in the lifetime of our children and our children's children. I want to thank you for being a great audience this afternoon, for braving the very unusual heat in San Diego, and mostly for being interested in acquiring knowledge for things that really, really do count. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.